This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Based on a True Story, a memoir by Norm MacDonald. Read by Norm MacDonald with Tim O'Halloran. Dedicated to Charles Manson. Not that one. Three Fingers Whiskey pleasures the drinkers. Moving does more than that drinking for me. Willie, he tells me the doers and thinkers say moving's the closest thing to being free. Billy Joe Shaver, Willie the Wandering Gypsy and me. To live outside the law, you must be honest. Bob Dylan, Absolutely Sweet Marie. I know of only two very real evils in life, remorse and illness. Leo Tolstoy, War and Peace.
Introduction. Found alive in a hotel room in Edmonton. You're dead. The hell I am, they'll see. I'd heard this kind of talk before. How I'm finished. Through. Obsolete, passé, yesterday's news. A has-been, a fossil. Why, I'll have you know, I'm just as relevant today as I was 25 years ago. No, my agent laughs through the phone, like it's the greatest joke in the world. Check your Wikipedia page. You're dead, all right. I look around the room and see the small bottles that are scattered everywhere. Those small bottles that make me feel so big. They're empty now, of course, just like me. My suitcase is in the corner, same one I've had my whole career. And it's all beat to hell, stitching coming out of the side, but still does its job. Shorter. Stand-up comedy is a shabby business, made up of shabby fellows like me who cross the country, stay at shabby hotels, and tell jokes they no longer find funny. You show up in a strange town, next thing you're gone. Then another town, and another, then a thousand more, then another. You're moving, always moving, like a criminal drifter, getting what you can from a place, and then getting out. You're never in one place long enough to experience anything but the shabbiest of love. I turned to look at the girl next to me in bed. I must have met her last night at the comedy club, where they had a great tall picture of me, leaning against the door, to remind the people what a big shot I once was. Her hair is bright yellow. Her lips are bright red. And she'll wake up soon, and I'll pretend that I remember her. I make my way quietly through the dim room to the wide-open minibar. It's empty, but for one tiny bottle way at the back. I always leave one. I drink her dry, the way a man puts gas in his car when the tank's near empty, just to keep going a little longer down the endless road. Damn near 50. Over at the table, I hit a couple of buttons on my computer and discover what my agent found so funny. Some joker has changed my Wikipedia page, all right, and he's left me for dead. Norm MacDonald, October 17th, 1963 to May 12th, 2013. Was a comedian, an actor, who was known from, I read on and on, till the final sentence, the death sentence. Mr. MacDonald was found dead in an Edmonton hotel room from an overdose of morphine. Well, that's a sight to see, all right, with all the authority of the Internet behind it, so I'm standing stock still in the very same Edmonton hotel room where I died the night before. And then I start to laugh. And I laugh to beat all get out, just like my agent did, just because I'm alive and I can. Then a thought comes to me in a sudden. A thought that stops all my laughing. Makes me real cold. It has me craving a couple of grains of morphine, or at least some whiskey. And the thought is this. The preposterous lie on the screen before me is not that far off. After all, the only thing this joker really did was change tenses, turned does to did, is to was. He got the date of my passing wrong, for sure, but nothing else. To misquote Twain, it turns out the rumor of my death is only slightly exaggerated. So now, I start to read this thing on the computer again. Only this time, I read it the way I imagine a stranger will, in a few years or a few decades, when it's true. You know, in the future, when I was Norm MacDonald. So this is my life, then. These words on this screen. Well, it doesn't add up to much. Just a series of facts. And I suppose that's what a man's life is, after all. But it's more than that, too. I mean, it has to be, doesn't it? And so I decide I will write an account of my life, my own self. My side of the story. Damn near 50. The girl on the bed is beginning to stir now, and I feel sorry for her, same way I feel sorry for myself every time I have to wake up. I struggle to remember her name, but it's just no good. And as I look at her and wonder who we were last night, I come up with a title for my book. Well, I'll call it Based on a True Story, because it comes to me that there's no way of telling a true story. I mean a really true one, because of memory. It's just no good. It's like when a guy is telling a story and he's way off. And you know he is, because the whole story is about you. But he's changing it all around, leaving out important parts, making up others from whole cloth, doing whatever he has to do to turn the dead stuff of life into something worth telling. And you'd correct him. But the thing is, you're not sure you remember it 100% accurately yourself. It turns out your memory is not the precise court stenographer you think it is, getting every word down just so. It's more like the sketch artist way at the back of the courtroom, who is doing his level best to capture images that no longer are. So, it won't be a true story. It'll be based on a true story, like every story I've ever told. But I promise you this, it'll be the truth, every word of it, to the best of my memory. And I won't just scratch the surface either, no siree, Bob. I'll claw and tear into this showbiz career of mine, and I'll let the filth fly like a mad dog digging up bones he buried deep and long ago. And I'll name names, and I'll drop bombshells. I bet they'll pay good money for that kind of thing, for the straight dope and the Hollywood crowd and the SNLers, too. And I need money. I need money to live. Damn near 50. I open the curtains and it's raining outside. I catch an image of myself in the window, and the rain blurs my thin reflection as if I'm barely there at all. And I see there's a bruise under my left eye and some dried blood. I look down at my hand, and the heel of my thumb is swollen purple and hurts like a bastard. And that makes me happy. It means the girl on the bed was fought for and not bought. She's full awake now. She's holding her head and squinting, and I watch her as she sees me. I can tell she doesn't remember anything either. Well, that's okay. I'll hear all about it later from the guy who runs the comedy club, and I'll sit and listen, transfixed, to the forgotten details of last night, and I'll shake my head bewildered, feeling like a trespasser in my own life. I look at the girl squarely. I'll get us a bottle. She has a pretty smile. Chapter 1. The Job Interview. Lauren, we'll see you now. He was always Lauren, never Mr. Michaels. He was smart that way. I took a seat across the desk from him, and there was a container of pencils that had been sharpened that very day, and a bowl of fresh popcorn, and plenty of Coca-Cola. Swell office you got here, Lauren. Thank you, Norm. I understand you're from Canada. Yes, sir, I said. And I knew that even though we hail from the same nation, we were worlds apart. He was a cosmopolite from Toronto, worldly, the kind of guy who'd be comfortable around the Queen of England herself. Me, I was a hick. born to the barren, rocky soil of the Ottawa Valley, where the richest man in town was the barber. Lorne was a big shot, and I was a small fry, and that's why I was planning on doing very little talking in this job interview. First, let me say that Lorne is often portrayed as an intimidating man, and he is. In some ways, he can't help it. He is quietly confident, smart, funny, and he always carries a dagger. These four qualities combine to make for an intimidating man. He had beautiful assistants that the writers had derisively nicknamed the Lornettes. These girls secretly loved Lorne, and also openly loved him. In another room, the writers sat around and they did impressions of Lorne that didn't sound anything like him. This is the way it is, with all big shots and all small fries everywhere, and it's been like that since the get-go. The boss is always a big joke, just dumb and lucky, and nobody's afraid of him at all, and everybody has a good laugh at him. Until he walks into the room, that is. It's a different story then. Lorne began the interview by telling stories, and I just listened, and I nodded and laughed when I was supposed to, same way I did in every job interview I've ever had. But this guy was different. First thing I noticed was that he was funny, really genuinely funny, and that is very rare for a big shot, especially a big shot in comedy. He had all these first-hand stories he was telling me about back in the day, when he worked on shows in Toronto, then in Hollywood. And he smiled when he told the stories, the kind of smile a man gets when memory transports him to another place and another time. He had worked on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour and a few Lily Tomlin specials. And there were famous celebrities in his stories, and all the stories were funny. And pretty soon my pretend laugh was turning into an honest-to-God real laugh, and I was choking on popcorn and coughing Coca-Cola. We were having a grand old time, until suddenly Lorne got down to business. So, Norm, let me tell you how the audition process works. We go down to the studio and you show us two characters. Well, I hadn't expected this. I'd been told this meeting was a mere formality. As long as I didn't insult Lorne outright, the job was mine. I'd been misinformed. Oh, well, you see, Lorne, the thing is this. I'm a nightclub comic. Jokes, crowd work, that kind of thing. But I'm a hard worker, and I catch on real fast. Besides, I understand I've been vouched for. And I had been, too. By Jim Downey, the head writer and second in command. By David Spade, the comic actor. Why, even by Adam Sandler himself. Yes, I've heard good things, but the thing is, you're a stand-up comedian. We are a variety show, and I have to be sure you will be able to provide versatility. I don't want to waste your time or mine. I wasn't sure he cared about wasting my time, since I'd been left in his waiting room for 4 hours, waiting and waiting and waiting. Tell me another story about Lily Tomlin, Lorne, I blurted out. I figured if he could tell me another funny story, I could start laughing again, and we could go back to those great times we were having a few moments ago. But no dice. Then he unsmiled his lips, and he got real plural on me. "We'll let you know," he said. And he looked down at a blank piece of paper on his desk. Well, you'd think he was a generous hatter, and I was the tallest man in the whole wide world, the way he gave me the high hat that day. I staggered to my feet, sweating hard, chugged down the last of the Coca-Cola, as Lorne meticulously studied that blank piece of paper, the way I'd imagine a sculptor might study a mountain of rock. I had to think, and think fast. But that's not easy for me. I think slow, real slow. I felt like I was back in first grade, and I just failed, as I always did. But that made me think of something else. You see, a lot of times, when I hadn't finished my homework, I would bring the teacher a shiny red apple and present it to her. It would always work. Of course, what would a teacher rather do, read scribbled nonsense from a 5-year-old, or eat a shiny red apple? But I wasn't dealing with a first-grade teacher here. This was the legendary Lorne Michaels, and he was not known for changing his mind once it was made up. Was there a chance I could red-apple the old man? I didn't know. But I did know. I was lucky enough that day to have a shiny red apple in my back pocket. Well, I didn't have an actual shiny red apple. That would have been perfect. But that's not how things work in this here life. I did happen to have the closest thing to a shiny red apple in my back pocket. My actual back pocket. Listen, Lauren, I do have one character I've been working on. I think it's going to be a big hit. The biggest. But I don't want to do it down in the studio, see where some bum might steal it and take it for his own. I want to do it just for you, right here and now. Lauren looked up at me with that stare of his that passeth all human understanding. Go ahead, Norm. I reached inside my back pocket and pulled out a bag containing 7 grams of government-grade morphine and 2 brand-new Surettes, tossed them on his desk. I call this character The Connection. Norm, I confess that your antics are near amusing, but this is not what we at the show refer to as a character. Do you know what we call this at the show, Norm? No, sir. What? A recurring character. I was in. Chapter 2, A Debt Unpaid. I've been on the road a pickler's fortnight, and I'm dog tired. A great deal of time has passed since the girl with the bright yellow hair and the bright red lips told me that my writing a book wasn't the worst idea she'd ever heard. Since then, I traveled all the way to New York City to meet with a publisher. The publisher is a girl, and it's about time, I say. Her name is Julie, and she has brown hair and red lips. She got me a secretary who's good at typing, and I've been working nonstop. I spent a month in New York to begin writing the book. I'm 2 paragraphs into my 2nd chapter, and I'm looking forward to being a big-shot author. And why not? New York City was the site of my great success. I made it there, and then I didn't make it anywhere else. I guess Frank Sinatra isn't so smart after all. Well, I'm finally home in Los Angeles, and I'm at the very back table of the world-famous Comedy Store. I sit alone, surrounded by black. That's what I like about this place. The walls are black, and the floors are black, and the tables are black. And that suits me just fine. Everybody looks pretty much the same in the black. On my table sits a bottle of Wild Turkey 101, and there's a glass beside it. The glass is bone dry, just there for appearance. The bottle is half full. There's a guy up on stage, and I think he's saying some pretty important things, because people are clapping a lot and shaking their heads sadly. Why don't you do a set, says Adam Egott. Nobody wants to see me do a set. Sure they do. They love you. They'll get a big kick out of it. Adam Egott is the manager of the world-famous Comedy Store. As always, he has a lit cigarette stuck to his bottom lip. He shifts his eyes from side to side, and he looks like he wants to be anywhere other than here, all of which conspire to give him the look of a getaway car driver. And he doesn't know it yet, but soon he'll be just that. Adam Egott always wears a suit, the kind of suit a poor man thinks a rich man wears. He's a man who acts like a big shot, but he knows I know what he is. He was a small fry when I met him, and he's a small fry now. I've known him for a right smart spell since my days at SNL in New York City, New York. That's where I found him, making a living underneath the Queensboro Bridge, jerking off punks for $15 a man. He said he was 18 at the time. He looked considerably younger, but he had a car, so I made him my assistant. I figured I'd let him work at 30 Rockefeller Center, where his job was to do whatever it was I said, to make all my wishes real. He was good at it. Some men are just born to do other men's bidding, and Adam Egott is such a man. It's a gift that pocketed him plenty in the shadow of the bridge. And he can wear his big man suit and order around waitresses and busboys all he wants. But it doesn't impress me one bit. Like I said before, I know what he is, and he knows that I know it. Why don't you sit down and have a drink with me, I say. Norm, I've been sober for 5 years, 3 months, and 12 days. You know that. Well, then it sounds like you're due, I tell him. And then to punctuate my fine joke, I take a comically oversized swig from my bottle. The plain truth is that Adam Egan is an alcoholic, and that's why he doesn't drink. Me? I'm not an alcoholic, and that's why I do drink. Life sure is funny that way. But my heart goes out to Adam Egan, because an addiction is a deep hook, and sometimes the harder you wriggle to escape her, the deeper she goes. I should know, because I've got one of my own. I like to gamble. Gamble money on games of chance. And some have said that it's been the ruin of me. Go up and do a set. They'll love you. They're a great crowd. Oh, so you're saying they're such a great crowd that they'll even love the likes of me? No, you know that's not what I'm saying. Come on, Norm, as a favor to me, I promise they'll get a big kick out of it. There's a lady up on stage now, and she's saying the most unladylike things, quite shocking. The folks in the crowd are looking at each other astonished. They can hardly believe what they're hearing. And I can tell that they don't know what to do, so they decide to laugh. Fine, I say, I'll do a set. I shamble onto the stage. In stand-up, what you wear is very important. Some comics wear a pair of jeans and a T-shirt, trying to look like a regular Joe, so the crowd will relate to them. Others take the stage sporting a $10,000 suit as a sign of respect for the folks who came to hear them. Me, I wear the same thing I wear off stage: a Norm Show T-shirt, an SNL jacket, and a dirty work hat. I figure in show business, it never hurts to remind the folks just exactly who you are. I open with my surefire bit about answering machines, and the crowd doesn't get a big kick out of it at all. I continue to talk, and the words come out the same way they have for 30 years, but those words are only on my lips. In my mind, a plan is hatching. A plan has just somehow appeared in the emptiness of my brain and in the black silence of the black room. This plan is bright as a sun. I don't dare leave the cold, bare stage until the entire plan unspools. And when it finally fully reveals itself to me in all its God-made glory, I thank the silent crowd and take my leave. I stumble off stage to sarcastic applause, and some guy throws out his leg. I trip over it and go sprawling until my head hits something that's harder than my head, and this whole scene gets a bigger laugh than any of my jokes on stage did. I stagger to my feet and think about slugging the son of a bitch one. There was a time when I would have, too, but that was when I was young. Now the world is young, and I'm a weak old man. I spot Adam Egan in the shadows. Sorry, Norm, I thought it was a good crowd. Guess I misread them. Yeah, well, I got to be able to read to misread, I say, and laugh loudly at my own quick wit. Touché, says Adam Egan. I hate when people say touché after you say something funny. I don't know what it means, but I know that I hate it. Anyway, it was my fault. I shouldn't have convinced you to go up there. Best thing you could have done, Adam Egan. But they didn't laugh at a single thing you said. It's not about what I spoke, but what was spoke to me, I say. And Adam Egan looks puzzled. I know I'm not making a lick of sense, but I'm happy and frightened at the same time, and I generally don't like feeling two things at once, unless they're very similar things. A plan came to me, Adam Egan. You get the challenger and bring her around. We're going to Vegas tonight. I can't, Norm. I'm the manager here now. I'm an important man with responsibilities. I can't just leave work. Well, they'll have to find another chimp, I say. Get the car. Norm, I'm not your assistant anymore. I'm my own man. Oh, you don't remember what happened on the boardwalk of Atlantic City, Adam Egan? It's been some time, but I thought you might remember. I remember. And that is that. Adam Egan just shakes his head and looks real sick. He's certainly about to lose his job and everything he's worked to achieve. The simple fact is, Adam Egan has a debt unpaid. It's 2 decades old, but I'm calling in my markers. So what choice does he have? He just nods his head a little and makes his way to the parking lot as I finish the bottle of Wild Turkey 101
and smile at the simple perfection of the plan, a plan that came from God himself and revealed itself to me in the unlikeliest of places. Adam Egott pulls the car around and I get in. He drops me off at Sullivan's boarding house. I pack all my Norm Show t-shirts, dirty work hats, and SNL jackets while he waits in the car. Then we are gone, moving fast, tearing the tar off Highway 15, all the way to Las Vegas, Nevada, aiming the white Challenger directly into the blood-red moon, like a snowball rolling straight to hell. Chapter 3, My First 5 Years. It doesn't take me long to understand. I should have waited a little before this drive to Vegas. Adam Egott worked all night, setting off in the smallest morning hours for a 5-hour drive with a clown at the wheel who refuses to take the magic pills that keep you awake. It's just plain stupid. But there's something about Las Vegas that makes you want to be there right now. The white Challenger is having trouble staying in its lane, and Adam Egott has a heavy-lidded look to him. In front of us, a semi full of trembling logs weaves close, and as its tail takes a swipe at the Challenger, I yell, and Adam Egott gives his head a quick shake. I know I'd better tell him a story, give him something to focus on. You know, that's the job of a passenger in a car on a long road trip, after all. So I pull out a vial of liquid morphine and sink my cigarette in it. The narcotic dries fast, adhering to the tobacco. I light up and inhale deeply, listening to the wondrous crackling as the fire hits my lungs and the smoke hits my brain. Then the smoke clears, and in the place where it was is now a picture. The picture is of a tough old farm, 100 acres of godforsaken, hard and unyielding soil, with a broke-down house and a barn that's in even worse shape, red paint peeling down its side like dried blood. There are 30 head of dairy cattle, 50 chickens, 5 hungry hogs, and 1 obsolete mule. And there are 7 hicks there as well. There in the field I see my father, scythe in hand, sweating hard as the hay falls before him. He works from sun to moon, stopping only for moments to wipe his already soaked handkerchief across his ruddy brow. At the well, my mother is pumping water from 100 feet below the earth and filling buckets that should be too heavy for such a slight young woman. On the porch of my home, my grandmother is sitting in a hardwood chair with an axe in her hand, and dancing in broken circles with a roaring fountain of blood where its head should be is a Dominicker hen. Tonight's dinner. I turn my head toward the car window, but I see no desert. I see the North 40, where old Jack, the hired hand and the best man I've ever known, is driving a tractor twice as old as he is. The tractor has an orange triangle on its back, and it bounces over the uneven earth. It's plain to see that the small, hard seat is hurting old Jack. In the wagon behind the tractor is my younger brother, Leslie, squealing delight in a carnival of hay bales. Walking down the lane with long arms full of short logs is my older brother, Neil. Neil is the only one of us kids who has to do chores. He is 9 years old. My grandmother says he's between grass and hay. I see the cat, who's licking himself and swatting horseflies with his tail as he lies beneath an improbably large maple tree that is blighted and dying. I look up the tree and see there is something up high, too, hiding in one of the crooks of its reaching branches, something that is watching. And the back of my head hits the headrest as I see that the thing in the tree is me. I look to Adam Egott and see that he's beginning to drift away, and I understand that I've been silent this whole time. I take a long drag from my magic cigarette, close my eyes again, and a new and brighter picture displays itself before me. I begin to speak what it is that I see. When I was young, I was in great shape. I was in my peak physical condition back when I was 1. Man, I looked great.
I even looked good for my age. Strangers would always approach me, smiling. And they'd say, look at you, little boy. What are you, zero? Oh, no, my mother would giggle. He's one. Well, I'll be danged. He doesn't look a day past zero. Oh, no, he's one, she'd blush proudly. My mother did all my talking for me back then because I hadn't got the hang of it yet. Back then, my best friend was a cat who only knew one word, meow. But at the time, it was one more word than I knew. I thought the cat had it all figured out. While my mother and father raced and chased through the world, the cat luxuriated on the hard wooden floor. His eyes were green and shone like the moon. And when the cat rubbed up against my belly, I could feel his purr deep inside me, as if I was the one purring. And this made me feel just as happy as a cat. Those were sweet days, I'm here to tell you. Mostly on account of the way everyone was so mightily impressed by anything I'd do, and I mean anything. I'd walk into the room holding a grape. Look who has a grape! Aren't you the smartest boy in the whole wide world? Sometimes all I had to do was show up. Look who it is! Did you come out to see what was going on in here? Aren't you the smartest boy in the whole wide world? Truth is, everyone had to be somewhere, and I was there, that's all, just as they all were. But I wasn't going to turn down any of these compliments. They thought I was pretty special, all right, and that was fine by me. It seemed like life was going to be nothing but swell, with me spending my time doing what I damn pleased, and everybody else spending their time being impressed. All that changed one day, when I was about 3 years old. I came busting into the parlor where my folks were sitting with my grandma. And in my hand was a grape. Look here, I said, just as proud as sin. I found another grape. Then eat the damn thing, said my father. You'll do no such thing, my mother told me, and then turned to my father. There's no telling where he found it. I was frightened and confused because I sensed something had changed irrevocably. As I left the room, I heard my grandma say, is there something wrong with that boy? I love my grandmother. Everything she did had to do with the making of food for the rest of us. I would lie on the cold linoleum of the kitchen floor and watch her work. My favorite was when she'd reduce vinegar. When vinegar is reduced, it becomes its own essence. All that is not necessary evaporates. And my grandmother said that all it takes for that reduction to take place is time. Just time. There was a picture of my grandmother on the kitchen wall, a picture of her as a young woman, and I would look between the picture and my grandmother and be unable to recognize each and the other. In the picture, she was plump and large. Outside the picture, she was thin and shrunken. There was no fat on her at all. I could see the way her flesh draped over her bones. Sometimes I would shudder. And, of course, there was old Jack, who to this day is the most unforgettable fellow I've ever met. My father once told me how he had come to be hired. Seems old Jack just showed up one day and asked if there was work to be had. Plenty of work, my father replied, but can't afford you. Then I'll work for nothing, said old Jack. And so he did. Old Jack lived in a tool shed way back in the North 40, and for his work he got 3 squares a day, and that was it. But I think he got more than that, because old Jack never mentioned family or home, and so I think he got that in the deal, too. My favorite times were in the evening, when my father would have company over. That's what we called it back then, company. And the old men would show up at the house and take a chair and a beer, and they'd Cracker Barrel the night away. My father was old when I was born. He was 2 generations before me. Years before he met my young mother, he had served in the war. All our neighbors were my father's age, so I was always around old ones growing up, and that suited me just fine. There was Bill Delaney, who could fix anything needed fixing. Tommy Jackson, the town barber. One time, he had a hippie from Cornwall come in for a trim, but Tommy forced a proper haircut on him. There was Angus McGregor, and he was a fine fellow for the most part, but when he hit the jug too deep, his words would start to get obscene, and then profane. And then my father would lay a cross look on him,
and Angus would lower his eyes and make his words clean. And, of course, there was always old Jack. They'd tell stories from the old days, from the war, from the Depression, and they'd tell jokes, too. My father would always tell the best jokes, and after the punchline, everybody would laugh to beat the band, including my father. And then, as the laughter was dying down, my father would repeat the punchline, and everybody would start laughing again. The best joke I remember my father telling was the one about the old fellow whose memory was failing him. "Did you ever hear tell of the old fellow who's having trouble remembering things? So he goes to the doctor, and the doctor prescribes him a medicine." "Well, don't believe I have, Lloyd," said Angus. "Well, his friend comes over one day and says, 'Jim, I understand you got some medicine for your memory. Now tell me, does it work?' 'Oh, yes,' says Jim. 'Works like a charm.' 'Well, I'd like to get some of that medicine for myself. What's the name of it?' 'Oh, the name of it,' says Jim. Let me see. I can't remember. Now, what's the name? What's the name of that flower?' 'Oh, I don't know,' says Jim's friend. 'There's so many. Is it a tulip?' 'No. No, it's that flower you take on a date with a woman.' 'Oh, is it a carnation?' 'No, no. It's the romantic one. It's red and long-stemmed.' 'Oh, you must mean a rose.' 'Yes, that's it,' says Jim. 'Rose! What was the name of that medicine the doctor gave me for my memory?'" Well, everybody would laugh hard, and my father the hardest of all. And then, just as the laughter began to subside, he'd repeat, "Rose, what's the name of that medicine?" And everybody would laugh harder still. I would laugh, too, sitting cross-legged in the corner. I loved all my dad's jokes. But the real stories were better than the jokes, of course. They were the tales of when these old men were young men, living through the Depression, when there was nothing to be had. And if you couldn't find work, there was no government to bail you out, so you just went hungry. My dad became a railroad bum during those times. He owned nothing in the whole world but his own soul, and even that he knew could be taken from him. He kept busy avoiding people like Kitchener Leslie, an infamous Canadian National Railway cop, who was much scarier than the real police. If he found a bum on the property of CN Railway, sitting in an empty boxcar of a train, he would stomp and stomp with his steel-toed boots till the railroad bum was gone, and only the gray, still flesh of the bum remained in his place. Of course, the men told stories of when war came to Europe and turned scared boys from Moose Creek into heroes at Normandy. Old Jack, he could tell the best stories, because his were the most mysterious. It seems old Jack never had a home, that he somehow just sprang from the land itself, full-grown, and had been roving his whole life till he settled down with us. He'd been in the war, too, just like the rest of them, but he never told a single war story. His tales were about wandering the Canadian byways, filled with drink and song and loneliness and new places and friends. And they always held the other old men in thrall. And me, too. I had never made it past Moose Creek, and I knew I never would. Round about 10 o'clock, the men would be on their way, taking the happy loudness with them and leaving the farmhouse quieter than the crickets and the frogs outside. Then old Jack would say thank you to my dad and see a sprite to me before he trundled out and down the lane to the tool shed that was his home. Chapter 4, 6 years old to 8 years old. One day when I was 6 years old, I came to know a truth, a hard truth that would stay with me for the rest of my life. I was in the farmhouse alone, and I happened to look out the screen door where I saw our cat. She was crouching close to the ground and utterly still, except for her tail, which switched like a metronome side to side. I could see the cat's muscles roiling beneath her blue-gray fur. Her eyes shone fire upon a mouse that sat roughly a foot in front of her. Neither animal moved, and I didn't either, but I could feel my heart beating. The standoff ended when the mouse finally moved and the cat caught it with a swift, clawless swat. The mouse stopped. After a brief moment of stillness, the mouse moved again. The cat met it with another swipe. And once again, the mouse stopped. This happened many times. Then the mouse began to back up slowly, and the cat went into a deep crouch, and then a mighty pounce. The mouse was trapped between the cat's two paws. It struggled to get away, but its efforts were futile, and the cat brought its face close to the mouse, who, in a desperate bid for freedom, bit the cat's nose. The cat's face momentarily recoiled in astonishment. Then the cat's green eyes flashed black like the wing of a crow, and her teeth tore into the mouse, and I could hear the tiny bones breaking as the cat's neck swung from side to side until the mouse was still and limp, but the cat's neck continued to swing. Then the cat slung the dead mouse into the short hay and strolled away. This last moment was what surprised and frightened me the most. This whole endeavor had nothing to do with food. And this is when I learned that hard-scrabble truth. There is a difference between what a thing is and what it appears to be. A thing can appear to be content and happy as it lies with you so close that you feel its purr in your belly. And if you don't look through the screen door and out into the world, you might never realize that the thing you think you know and love is another, more dangerous thing altogether. Once I learned this truth, I began to see examples of it everywhere. A picture hung on the wall of our parlor. In it, a woman was taking a shirt from a clothesline. She had clothespins in her teeth, and it was windy, and a boy was tugging at her dress. The woman looked like she was in a hurry, and the whole scene gave me the idea that just outside the frame, full dark clouds were gathering. But that was not what it was. It was paint. So I decided right then and there to see the picture as it really was. I stared at the thing long and hard, trying to only see the paint. But it was no use. All my eyes would allow me to see was the lie. In fact, the longer I gazed at the paint, the more false detail I began to imagine. The boy was crying, as if afraid, and the woman was weaker than I had first believed. I finally gave up. I understood then that it takes a powerful imagination to see a thing for what it really is. That was when I became very interested in magic. A magician can make you believe in appearances even if they are impossible. And lucky for me, old Jack was a magician. Also, he was the only one of the old men who paid me any attention. Once I showed my interest in magic, he began to perform his sorcery for me regularly. He could make a penny vanish from his hand and then find it in my ear moments later. He could turn a penny to a nickel, and a nickel to a quarter, until you couldn't understand why he wasn't the richest man alive. Old Jack could do it all. His tricks amazed me. But I knew they weren't real, even at that young age, because I had seen the cat and mouse and thought about the picture in the parlor. So I asked Old Jack to teach me, but he refused. "Can't do that, Sprite. A magician never tells his secrets." But when he said that, it was always with a winking sort of smile, and I understood that one day he would tell me. 2 years passed, and as I grew older, I was eager to become a man. On the first Sunday of every month, just before the sun rose, all the men in town would convene at our home to go hunting with my father and my older brother. I wanted to hunt more than anything else, but I was not allowed. In my father's eyes, I wasn't old enough and couldn't be trusted with a gun in the woods, even though I could already hit a can off a fence post with a .22 9 times out of 10. It wasn't fair, but I didn't make the rules, so I had to stay home with the women and Old Jack. See, Old Jack never went hunting, not once, not ever. And the men teased him without mercy. But Old Jack, he'd just smile and say, "Wish I could, boys, but I'm getting behind on my work." But everybody knew that Old Jack was never behind when it came to work. One Sunday, I asked Old Jack straight out why he wouldn't go hunting, and his answer made me wish I hadn't asked. He said that when he was young, he was the best shot in the county, and he could shoot a squirrel's eye out at 40 feet. So when he was drafted into the war, they made him a sniper. He told me that he had killed and killed for 4 years, and he said that that kind of killing changes a man. He knew they never would have made him kill all those men if he had not learned to shoot so well as a boy. He said when he returned to Canada, he felt apart from other men and felt closer to little children who hadn't yet learned to hate. And I asked old Jack if he figured he could still shoot a squirrel's eye out at 40 feet. "I don't know," old Jack said. "I love squirrels now. I've even trained one. I feed him corn right from my hand, and he climbs onto my shoulder. Now that's got to be kept a secret, Sprite, because if another man found that out, I'm afraid that he would kill my squirrel and dry it on the porch till it was ready to eat." I knew old Jack was right about that. The men in our town love to eat squirrel. "Where is the squirrel, old Jack?" "Well, he lives in the tool shed with me. Falls asleep right on my belly. I guess I'm the only fella on this blessed earth who has a squirrel for a pet. Will you show him to me, old Jack?" "I can't do that, Sprite. He might get spooked and bite you. Maybe I'll just teach you a magic trick instead." So old Jack finally showed me how to produce a nickel from behind a boy's ear. And once I knew how it was done, once I knew the trick for what it really was, I became angry. I made old Jack promise that from now on he would only perform his magic tricks and never tell me the truth behind them. Things were changing fast for me. The night of my 8th birthday was a night like any other. I was sitting, listening to the men, when Angus MacGregor started talking about the war. Well, I could tell Angus had uncorked the jug early that day. He looked drunk as a boiled owl, and his story didn't make much sense. He said how much he hated the Krauts, and that he had once shot a surrendering soldier in the back, and he told us he wasn't sorry for it neither. None of the men said anything for a while after that, and finally my father broke the silence. "I'll get us another round of beers." When I looked over at old Jack, there was a tear in his eye. I'd never seen that before, a tear in a man's eye. He got up and quietly left the house, and I chased after him. When I found him, he was sitting under the blighted maple tree. "You sad, old Jack? You thinking about the war?" I asked. Old Jack just sat still for the longest time, like I wasn't even there. It was like he couldn't hear or see me, like he was hearing and seeing different things. So I just stood there. And after a good long time, old Jack looked up and seemed surprised that I was in front of him. "Well, hello, Sprite," he said. "What's the matter? You look kind of down." "Well, I just didn't like Angus MacGregor's story, that's all." "Say, Sprite, I know what'll lift your spirits. Well, I know the very thing. How'd you like to see a trained squirrel?" I was very excited. "But you said you could never show him to me, old Jack." "I haven't got the money to get you a true birthday present, Sprite. This'll have to do." So we walked down the lane together toward the North 40. The beneficent moon hung low and shone bright, leading us to the shed. When we arrived there, I was so excited I couldn't wait. I pushed the door open and rushed inside, looking for that squirrel, but I couldn't find him. I realized my mistake that he'd only come out for old Jack. So I glanced back at the open door where old Jack stood, but his back was to me now, and it was blocking out the light of the moon. I suddenly remembered that I'd read somewhere how the light of the moon was just an illusion, and the moon was only a cold, cold stone. I watched old Jack look from side to side before he turned his gaze on me, and his eyes flashed black like the wing of a crow. He closed the door, and the inside of the shed went black. Then I heard the bolt. I forget what happened next. Chapter 5. 8 years old to 13 years old. I forget. Chapter 6, 13 Years Old. Those lost years of mine sure made for a lot of teasing from my family, I'm here to tell you. "Hey, Nora," my father would say as we ate our supper, "tell us a story from when you were 9, or 10, or even 12, it don't matter which." And I'd think just as hard as I could, narrowing my eyes and clenching my teeth, anything, to try to force a memory to the surface. "Can't remember, Dad." And the whole table would laugh and laugh. And then my father would tell a story about me from that time. A story about me losing a tooth playing hockey. Or me dropping a coal oil lamp in the tool shed and damn near burning it down. Or me getting a hold of my father's 12-gauge and shooting 6 holes into the tool shed like it was some sort of dangerous beast. They would always be great, funny stories. And I knew they were true. I had just forgotten them, that's all. When I finally woke up from my 5-year walking sleep, it was as if no time had passed from that moment in the tool shed looking at old Jack and thinking how his eyes looked like the cat's. The very next moment, I was sitting in the back of my father's car with my 2 brothers. My father was at the wheel, and he was telling my mother that when it was his turn, he'd be grateful to go the same way as old Jack. And my mother agreed and said that the doctors had told her that old Jack's was the most peaceful death he'd ever witnessed. When I heard old Jack's name, I couldn't find my breath, and I snatched my older brother's sleeve in a panic. But he just looked annoyed and swatted my hand away. When we got to Coleman's funeral home, Lyle Coleman, the undertaker, was there to meet us. "Is your boy all right, Lloyd?" asked Lyle. I was shaking in an awful way. "Well, everyone loved old Jack," my father said. "My middle boy's just more sensitive than most." "Lloyd, this is the only funeral we've ever had here at Coleman's where there's no family. Surely old Jack has some kin still alive." "Wouldn't know, Lyle," my father said. "All I'm sure of is that for the last 20 years, we were old Jack's family, and that's how we'll mourn him." My brothers were talking, and one said to the other, "I've never seen a dead man before. What do you think he'll look like?" And hearing that, I ran down the dirt road as fast as I could. My father found me under an old tree that was sick with Dutch elm disease. He sat down and told me that when a man is born, he is born with a great debt, and that one day the debt must be paid. I said that it was unfair, that others should have to pay before old Jack. But my father explained that the rain falls on all of us, the wicked and the righteous alike. He told me that a man would be judged by his works, and that made me feel better, because I knew old Jack had led a fine and good life. My father told me I had to be strong, that old Jack would want it that way. I reckoned he was right. So I got up and walked, and my father walked behind me with his right hand on my left shoulder, guiding me back to the funeral home to say goodbye to old Jack before Lyle Coleman took him under. The room was filled with folks who talked to each other about old Jack and what they remembered of him, which wasn't much. He worked hard and he stayed to himself, never complained or had a bad word to say about anyone. The Reverend got up and said what a great man old Jack was, how he had fought bravely in the war and lived the rest of his life serving God and working the fields. I got in line with my father, and we inched solemnly toward the pine box that would be old Jack's house from here on in. Suddenly I was next, and fear grabbed my throat and squeezed, and I gasped and pulled my tie off. "You okay, son?" my father asked. "Sure I am," I said. But I was lying. I wasn't okay at all. My brothers were okay, that's for sure, and were already in line to view the body for a second time, as if they were going on a ride in the state fair. A wild fear seized me, that as soon as I looked into the casket, old Jack would grab me and pull me into the pine box with him, and nobody would see, and I would be trapped forever, like a squirrel in a pitch-black shed, a squirrel trained by a magician to perform unspeakable tricks. And then I felt my father's hand gently on my back, and I knew it was my turn, and I wasn't going to run. So I stepped alone to the coffin and looked into it. And when I looked inside, a curious thought struck me, a thought that made my fear evaporate and my tears dry. You see, old Jack wasn't lying in the casket. Why, it wasn't him at all. It was just something that looked like him, the same way a suit lying on a bed resembles the man once wore it. Old Jack was the best fellow I ever knew, and I'd been with him as often as anyone. But I wasn't with him that day. Not there, in that room, where a line of people stood waiting to look at a thing in a box. Chapter 7, Driving to Las Vegas. The stories of my youth are working wonderfully, and Adam Egitt is awake, annoyingly awake. He suddenly can't stop talking long enough to shut up,
about how his girlfriend broke up with him just last week, and how he lost his BlackBerry, which has his sponsor's phone number on it, and how they don't appreciate him enough at the world-famous comedy store. And me, I'm riding shotgun, listening to Billy Joe Shaver on the radio, and thinking about the plan. I stare out at the black, starless night. I only have $200 to my name, but I have a plan. And the good thing about the plan is that it's foolproof. So I decide I'll get some shut-eye now that Adam Egan is exceptionally awake. I close my eyes and turn the car radio way up, and Billy Joe Shaver's voice drowns out Adam Egan's. The devil made me do it the first time. A second time, I'd done it on my own. And I smile as I fall asleep. The slam of the car door wakes me, and my dreams fall away as the facts of my life tumble back into my empty head. I'm alone in the car and look out to see that I'm at the edge of the desert, the godforsaken desert where the snakes go hungry and die eating dirt. I see that Adam Egan is out there, pacing around, agitated, a cigarette stuck to his mouth like always, like they must teach everyone to do at AA. And he's cursing a sky that has no stars. So I ask him what the problem is. Well, this is where Kinnison died, Norm. Jesus. If that's true, Adam, you took a detour off Highway 15. It's going to set us back at least an hour. I get out of the Challenger with the intention of giving Adam Egan a good old-fashioned beating. But then I realize this is sacred ground, after all. I put one knee down in the hard sand, bow my head, and close my eyes. Sam, the last original voice in comedy, silenced forever when a drunk in a pickup hit him head-on. After the crash, Sam got out of the car, walked around, talked to his best friend Carl LeBove, and then finally to God himself. He had heard something out there that Carl hadn't, and he seemed at peace with it as he lay down and his spirit rose into the cold desert air. It's sacred ground, all right. You knew him, Norm. Adam Egan was kicking the hard sand as if the desert itself was to blame. Yeah, I knew him, all right. When I first started out, he was real kind to me. Sam wasn't famous yet and couldn't get much work in the States, but Mark Breslin, the fellow who owned all the clubs up in Canada and gave me my start, he wasn't like a regular club owner. He hired Sam when no one else would, and that's how I came to know Sam. Did he kill every night, Norm? No. The fact was, he never killed at all. Mark Breslin had a bonus in Sam's contract that Sam would get an extra $1,000 every time he walked a room. But every single person had to leave. I saw Sam do it twice. Boy, those were crazy days, Adam Egan. Crazy, beautiful days. Why didn't he kill? How do I know? Truth was, it was a mystery because he could shake a room to its foundations, and the folks knew that something was going on, but they'd get up and leave just the same. Maybe folks don't want anything new. Maybe they just want to hear the things they already know. How the hell should I know? What was he like before he was famous, Norm? Oh, well, he was a sight to see. The rest of us, we all dressed in suit jackets and shoes like our dads wore, but Sam's jacket was a long duster. He always wore a bandana, too. And when he talked, it was a wild shriek, but there was music in it. It put me in mind of a Pentecostal minister I'd seen once who hailed from West Texas and came up through the Ottawa Valley when I was a young boy. A man who handled snakes and talked unafraid. Sam put me in mind of him, and for good reason, too. Turned out Sam used to be a preacher himself. Anyways, I was just starting out in comedy at the time. And Sam came through Ottawa, and he took a liking to me, so he let me travel with him and open for him all across Canada. I bet you have good stories about Sam, don't you, Norm? Oh, sure. I remember one time we were flying from Toronto to Winnipeg, Sam and I, and before we took off, the captain came over the intercom, as is the custom on airplanes. "Good morning," the captain said. "This is your captain, Pat Johnson. And we will be flying," and Sam gave out a wild scream. "No! No! Ah! Not Crash Johnson! Not Crash Johnson! Ah!" Well, it was about the funniest thing I'd ever heard. The idea that this captain had been in so many accidents that his nickname was Crash. Well, that just busted me up, and I started laughing and couldn't stop. Of course, nobody else found it funny at all. It caused quite an alarm.
and Sam got himself a good talking to by the girls that bring you the little drinks. But he didn't care. He had me laughing hard, which I guess was the only thing he was after. He apologized to the girls, giggling the whole time. You know, that old Sam giggle. "Yeah," says Adam Egott, "I really wish I'd met him, but it was before my time."